Gonzalez.
Good evening. This is a meeting of the San Francisco Commission on the Environment. The date is Monday, October 27th. The time is 5 p.m. Please note that the ringing and use of cell phones and similar devices is prohibited, and the chair may order the removal from the room of anyone using a phone or similar device. Public comment will be available for each item on the agenda. For comments on matters that are not on the agenda, there will be an opportunity for general public comment. Participants who wish to comment will be asked to come forward one by one and speak clearly into the mic. Each speaker will be allowed 3 minutes to speak. Members of the public may also submit public comment by email to environment@sfgov.org. Those comments will be forwarded to the commissioners and included as part of the official file. I will now call the roll. President Sullivan?
Here.
Vice President Tompkins?
Here.
Commissioner Ahn is excused. Commissioner Bermejo?
Here.
Commissioner Hunter?
Here.
Commissioner Riles?
Here.
Commissioner Yuen?
Here.
President Sullivan, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Alice. Item two is the President's welcome.
The next item is consent calendar, items two through four. Item two is the President's welcome. Item three is staff introductions with Director Tyrone Jew. And item four is approval of minutes of the September 22nd, 2025 Commission on the Environment meeting.
Thank you, Alice. The Commission on the Environment acknowledges that we occupy the unceded ancestral homeland of the Ramaytu Shalone peoples, who are the original inhabitants of the San Francisco Peninsula. We recognize that the Ramaytu Shalone understand the interconnectedness of all things and have maintained harmony with nature for millennia. We honor the Ramaytu Shalone peoples for their enduring commitment to Warup, Mother Earth. As the indigenous protectors of this land and in accordance with their traditions, the Ramaytu Shalone have never ceded, lost, or forgotten their responsibilities as the caretakers of this place, as well as for all peoples who reside in their traditional territory. We recognize that we benefit from living and working on their traditional homeland. As uninvited guests, we affirm their sovereign rights as First Peoples and wish to pay our respects to the ancestors, elders, and relatives of the Ramaytush community. As environmentalists, we recognize that we must embrace indigenous knowledge in how we care for San Francisco and all its people. Commissioners, staff, members of the public, welcome tonight. Today's agenda includes presentations on Chapter 7 and 14 of the San Francisco Environment Code, as well as a resolution encouraging city decision makers to support retaining this commission's government body status. With that, let's get started. So the next item is item three. Director Jew, would you like to introduce new staff?
Thank you, Commission President. We have one new hire to announce for this commission meeting. We have William Jen, who is joining the Municipal Toxics Reduction Program team as a program assistant. So William, please come up. William is coming over from another one of our programs, so he's an internal hire, and so we're really excited for William in his new role.
Yeah, thank you for that, Ty. Hello, commissioners. My name is William Zen. I've been with SFE for 2 years. I was on the outreach team before this, and now I'll be in the municipal toxics team working on the Buy Green program and IPM. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
That concludes.
Great. So the final item in the consent calendar are the minutes. Commissioners, we have an action item on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion or changes to the draft minutes? And if not, I have a motion and a second. Motion by Commissioner Bermejo and a second by Commissioner Riles. Let's go to public comment.
Are there any members of the public who wish to speak on items two through four only of the agenda? President Sullivan, we have no speakers.
Thank you. Then public comment is now closed. Alice, please call the roll.
President Sullivan?
Aye.
Vice President Tompkins?
Aye.
Commissioner Ahn is excused. Commissioner Bermejo?
Aye.
Commissioner Hunter?
Aye.
Commissioner Riles?
Aye.
Commissioner Yuen?
Aye.
The motion passes. Next item, please, Alice.
The next item is item five, general public comment. Members of the public may address the commission on matters that are within the commission's jurisdiction and are not on today's agenda. Are there any members of the public who wish to comment on this item? Please come forward and state your name.
Hello, and thank you, commissioners. My name is Sophie Constantino. And are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, again, Sophie Constantino. I am a Bay Area native, a San Francisco resident for a very long time, and I'm here with a very serious request from you. So I'm here to urge you to put the topic of artificial turf on the top of your commission agenda. It's imperative that you review the toxic impact of artificial turf on our ecology, soil, our water, our bodies. Right now, there are plans to convert 20 acres of Recreation and Parks Crocker Amazon natural athletic fields into artificial turf. And the plan is presented as inflexible. It will remove vast swaths of precious natural park and replace it with fenced-off plastic baseball fields. And for the record, the park can and should be renovated with state-of-the-art natural grass fields, but grass is not on the table. Grass grows by itself. The core contradiction that we need the Environment Department to weigh in on is this. There are forever chemicals in turf that are going to leach into the ground. Or are they going to contain these chemicals and therefore lose this permeable, healthy land? Crocker Amazon lies on top of the Public Utilities Commission's reservoir lands, so it's a pretty sensitive habitat. And I urge you to get some independent review. I think that there's an incredible amount of science and data. We read it all the time. I know you have access to it. We also have some data that is being given to the public from Recreation and Parks Department, and that feels like they have a very persuasive argument, and that data does not feel like it lines up with the national and international news that we're reading about PFAS. So there is a sort of a forever chemical urgency here with the PFAS that are going into the soils that come directly from these plastics and ultimately to us. So one of the questions that we want to know is how are they going to prevent this leaching and how is the leaching contained? But if it is totally contained, are we paving over this beautiful park? Is that my, 2 minutes?
26 seconds.
Okay, hurry up. Okay, so the imminent project at Crocker Amazon flies in the face of the Department of the Environment's Climate Action Plan. So Millbrae, Boston, they've banned artificial turf. Even Los Angeles is exploring a ban. So why are we letting artificial turf take over our athletic fields? It's bad for children. It's bad for the environment. You know that. So I urge you to draw on your expertise and make an examination of this toxic environmental hazard. Thank you so much.
You may come to the podium.
Hello. My name is Bob Hall. I bring you a bucket of microplastic turf. I co-led a bird walk at Crocker Amazon Sunday. We had about 30 participants. We got about 35 bird species there. You know, people underestimate the value of that place, but there are certain critters that really like the hillside from McLaren and the lawn, and because it's between San Bruno Mountain and McLaren, it gets a lot of activity. I've counted 3 bat species there on a late night bat walk, so it has stuff going on that we take for granted. But I'm here to talk about microplastics. My name is Bob Hall again. Microplastics are one of the most urgent environmental health threats facing San Francisco today. The San Francisco Estuary Institute's Contaminants of Emerging Concern study found that microplastics are now widespread in our bay and urban watershed. Coming from synthetic textiles, tire wear, and yes, plastic turf, like in this bucket. I collected this at the Ocean Beach Fields. In about 10 minutes, I filled up this bucket with these microplastics. These particles don't stay put. They move through the air, soil, and water, becoming part of our fog here, and become part of our food supply and our bodies. Yet here in San Francisco, Rec Park is proposing to add 20 more acres of plastic turf to Crocker Amazon, roughly 200,000 pounds of plastic that will weather, fragment, and shed microplastics into nearby neighborhoods, storm drains, and the bay. This is being proposed on the southeast side of the city, which already suffers from the highest asthma rates and environmental burdens. The California Department of Toxic Substances Control estimates that each artificial turf field sheds between 2,000 and 3,000 pounds of plastic, grass, that's just the grass blades, per year. DTSC noted that because of their small particle size, microplastics can become airborne and inhaled. While Rec Park is making perhaps impossible recycling claims, a 2024 study titled Global Discharge of Microplastics from Mechanical Recycling of Plastic Waste found that even plastic recycling processes release billions of microplastic particles. I urge the Environmental Commission to take a leadership role in addressing microplastic pollution citywide by opposing new artificial turf installations, supporting DTSC's effort to add microplastic to the candidate chemicals list, and recommending policies that protect residents from plastic exposure, especially in overburdened communities like Crocker Amazon. Thank you. It's nasty.
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Sean Auckland. This is my third time visiting you, asking for your help. Tonight, I speak on behalf of a growing citywide movement, which you can review at fairtrees.org. Since I was last here 2 months ago, over 600 San Franciscans have signed our petition. The Coalition for San Francisco Neighborhoods, representing 26 neighborhoods, passed a formal resolution demanding change. We have letters of support from across this city, and just this week, we were joined by the Marie Harrison Community Foundation of Bayview. Capping this, the UC Center for Climate, Health, and Equity sent a letter to the mayor recently stressing the, quote, urgent need to address how our inequitable canopy creates health burdens that result for our most marginalized communities. The city's response? To invoke a special exception without criteria to the sidewalk issue on my block while leaving the damaging policy in place for everyone else. So as a reminder, we pushed this issue to the Urban Forestry Council meeting. The policy itself states no street tree planting will be allowed in sidewalks with a width less than 7'6". Exceptions may be granted on a case-by-case basis. I was denied such an exception a couple years ago, and due to my advocacy, I was granted one for all 13 wells on my block only. This case-by-case system is a recipe for injustice. As the planning department's Ilaria Salvadori stated in the UFC meeting, asking the community to advocate individually for every street perpetuates inequity because the communities I work with, they don't have the capacity. Well, I do have the capacity and just managed to overturn my denial for 13 tree wells that do not meet the width requirement. The head of urban forestry has stated on the record his refusal to change this policy moments after admitting that self-advocacy neighborhood by neighborhood perpetuates, or sorry, his quote was, a self-propelling inequity. This refusal to fix a broken policy is matched by a refusal to collaborate. On September 3rd, I met in person with Public Works Director Carla Short, and she personally committed to working with us on an equity plan. I followed up days later and have received no response. This, despite pointing out that Los Angeles, Sacramento, and Oakland all have such equity plans. I then shared our research with Director Ju, asking for this department's help. Also, I received no response. Commissioners, the community has organized. The science is clear. Your own city planners are calling for change. I urge you to intervene and direct your department to do two things. One, work with Public Works to repeal and replace the prohibitive language. The Urban Forestry Council chair said it would remove the presumption that it is not plantable. And second, to present this commission with a public timeline for the equity plan that Director Short committed to 2 months ago. Again, you can find all of this at fairtrees.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other members of the public who would wish to provide comment on item 5? President Sullivan, we have no more speakers.
Thank you. Then public comment is now closed. Next item, please.
The next item is item 6, presentation on updates to Environment Code Chapter 14, construction and demolition debris recovery requirements. The speakers for this item are James Slattery, CND Zero Waste Senior Coordinator, Eric Pacewalk, CND Zero Waste Coordinator, and Ken Ronhan, CND Zero Waste Assistant Coordinator. This item is for discussion.
Good evening, commissioners. I'm James Slattery, the senior coordinator for the Construction and Demolition Zero Waste team. We'll go with C&D Zero Waste from here on out. I'm joined by my colleagues Eric Pasewalk and Kat Hanrahan, the team's coordinator and assistant coordinator, respectively. And tonight's presentation is intended to serve as the latest in a series of progress updates that we've been providing to the commission, along with some forecasts of intended next steps for how our team intends to implement and enforce the requirements of Chapter 14. Before we jump into the progress updates, just a quick reminder of how the city's C&D activities impact our zero waste goals. Building activities in San Francisco account for approximately 25% of what we landfill each year. It's about 125,000 of the 500,000 tons being landfilled each year. These activities are responsible for about 50% of the city's total solid waste generation. So that's about 922,000 of the 1.84 million tons of total solid waste generated each year. And in 2006, the adoption of Environment Code Chapter 14 established a prohibition on direct hauling these material discards directly to a landfill for disposal. In doing so, it established a material chain of custody framework that authorizes SF Environment to monitor how C&D discards are to be collected, transported, and brought to authorized sorting facilities or recycling markets directly. The authorities in Chapter 14 are hyper-focused on commingled and mixed debris or mixed discards, which is the preferred waste management strategy for most construction projects in the city. And under this framework, our team will monitor activities of the projects. These are the waste generators. We'll monitor activities of the haulers, those collecting and transporting the debris, as well as the facilities that are authorized to receive and process the discards from our projects in San Francisco. And in a moment, my colleagues are going to provide an overview of some key tactics and tools that we rely on to fulfill these obligations. Beyond the regulatory framework for C&D projects and how they can support zero waste objectives and the city's climate action goals, Chapter 14 serves as the means for how San Francisco complies with the state's construction waste reduction, disposal, and recycling requirements. These are established by CalGreen, the state's Green Building Code. Additionally, the Municipal Green Building Code here in San Francisco, Environment Code Chapter 7, also requires that all contracted C&D activities comply with Chapter 14. And so in pioneering these requirements, these programs, SF Environment has also informed how the U.S. Green Building Council transformed its LEED credit system for construction waste management practices. The code itself, since adoption, has been updated several times. Most prominently or most recently was an update in 2021. This set out new authorities, which then informed regulations that were adopted in 2023 for how we were going to begin conducting code enforcement of Chapter 14. You'll hear some more about those tactics and how we've been implementing them from my colleagues in a moment. This was the slide presented the last time we provided an update, which was in about two years ago, September of 2023. And I presented these next steps that are outlined on the slide. Tonight, you're going to hear from Kat and Eric on a progress update. First, though, I'll share for bullet point number two some updates on how we've been working to balance revenue projections and expenditures and right-size the team structure. On the chart you see here, what I'm measuring on the vertical axis is dollars, money, and on the horizontal axis, measuring time year to year. So from 2006 to 2019, the program was dependent on a loan source of funding that was provided through a work order from the Department of Building Inspection, and it accounted for one full-time position. It was increased slightly in fiscal year 19-20 to cover 1.5 full-time equivalent positions. And then in 2018-2019, a small amount of zero waste impound was directed to support our efforts, mostly to help research and develop new policies and programs in support of the new waste generation reduction goals. The funding from zero waste impound was increased slightly year over year. You'll see that's represented in the orange bars on the graph. The DBI work order is in the blue bars. And then in 2021, that update that we presented a couple of years ago, Chapter 14 received or authorized a new source of funding, which now stands as the most significant funding source for the program, and it allowed us to scale to 4.5 full-time equivalent positions, also allows us to work order monies to sister agencies like Public Works to help support implementation and enforcement. Our team continues to work closely with these partner agencies as well as the controller's office to figure out how to continue to right-size the programs and scale the impact of these new authorities. I'm happy to take questions on anything I presented, but first I'd like to pass it to my colleague Kat Hanrahan, who will give you some updates on our progress to date. Thank you.
Greetings, commissioners. As mentioned, I'm Kat Hanrahan, the assistant coordinator on the team, and I will be walking you through some of the outcomes that we've seen since implementing this new ordinance. So we've really standardized our approach to implementation through a few key tools for each node of the ecosystem. So for projects, that means oversight of the debris produced through review and approval of material reduction and recovery plans. For transporters, we've built out a robust mixed C&D transporter permit system. And for facilities, we utilize a third-party verification system to assess the accuracy of each registered facility's recovery rate. Our material reduction and recovery plans are currently processed and submitted online through Green Halo Systems. Permit applicants are required to open a Green Halo plan in order to receive their permit from the Department of Building Inspection and must submit documentation of disposal for review prior to closing out that permit. And you can see that the number of plans our team reviews and approves has continued to increase over the past few years. So currently we have upwards of 4,000 MRRPs completed, with about a fourth of them being finalized in this calendar year alone. And the types of projects subject to these MRRP requirements are governed by CalGreen, and it covers both commercial and residential projects that meet specific criteria. The transporter permits were one of the most prominent features introduced in the 2021 ordinance, and they've become a key component of our compliance monitoring. Similar to the trend in MRRPs, our permitted transporter network has been expanding over time. We have a progressive fee schedule with four different vehicle tiers in a debris box category to account for the different types of operators in this ecosystem, everything from small independent haulers and contractors to larger construction demolition companies and debris box fleets. On the graph in front of you, you can see that our consistent engagement with transporters both over Green Halo and through field visits has led to an overall increase in permits and revenue, especially in the Tier 1, our smallest transporter category, which is that orange bar. Compliance with both our Green Halo and transporter permit requirements has improved drastically through our enforcement program. We issued enforcement regulations in February of 2023 and an updated version in May of 2024, detailing the enforcement process, potential violations and corrective actions, and fine amounts. We use this procedure to issue notices of violation over the desktop through Green Halo, as well as for violations observed in the field. Since regulations have been signed into effect, we've issued over 400 inspection reports, and that includes notices of violation, warnings, and requests for additional documentation. Of those violations that were issued, 90% have been corrected, resulting in no fine, and only 26 fines have been issued. So our emphasis on technical assistance has really shown an increase in compliance without relying heavily on fines. So that's it for me, and I will pass it off to Eric to speak a little bit more about facilities.
Thank you, Kat. Thank you, commissioners. I'll start with the third node of implementation in our oversight of mixed C&D, which is recycling facilities. All facilities that receive mixed debris from San Francisco need to register with the Environment Department. This is important because these facilities and their recovery rates allow projects to meet the state CalGreen requirements of 65% diversion from landfill. The registration process has evolved over the years, most recently with the introduction of third-party verification of facility recovery rates, as we mentioned earlier. In addition to third-party verification, the registration process requires each of the current 14 registered facilities to submit an annual self-report and for SFE to conduct site inspections. These multiple touch points help SFE ensure a more reliable representation of debris recovery, so projects can choose the best pathway to meet state requirements and maximize resource preservation. With our most recent years of experience implementing these tools, we've gained numerous insights on our policies and potential opportunities at refinement. For projects, there are opportunities to enhance the requirements for material reduction and recovery plans, known as MRRPs, to better capture significant debris generation and also encourage higher and better outcomes like reuse of materials. For transporters, we want to simplify permit requirements and minimize loopholes for noncompliance. And for facilities, we hope to minimize administrative burdens and support the continued health and expansion of recovery markets. So looking ahead, we've identified three main themes that capture our intent for potential future updates to Chapter 14. We'd like to assist small businesses by supporting an open and competitive market for contractors, transporters, and facilities. We want to close compliance gaps to ensure that those who follow the rules benefit from the fair and equitable enforcement of requirements. And we finally want to streamline administrative processes to decrease the burden on businesses and increase the efficiency of implementation. Getting down to the nuts and bolts of these themes, wanted to highlight some specific updates that we're seeking to do with Chapter 14. We'd like to codify the provisional registration period for facilities that will help new facilities join the registered facility network without having to complete the entire registration process that can extend over months. We'd like to introduce a probationary action to allow registered facilities to correct noncompliance activities without having to be suspended. We're looking to allow compliant facilities to explore the possibility of conducting third-party verification every other year instead of every year. On the transporter side, we'd like to update some permit exemptions that are currently in our code to make them more clear and easily to enforce. We'd like to allow for the renewal of temporary permits instead of requiring a new application. These temporary permits are 7 days long, and requiring them to reapply after 7 days is excessively burdensome. And finally, we're looking to eliminate fee proration for applications that are submitted in response to an enforcement action. What we found is that as transporters are learning more about our program, they are going to discover that if they apply 6 months into the year, that the cost of their permit is going to be half as much, which may incentivize them to seek out to not participate in a compliant activity in order to get a discount on their permit fee. And finally, I'd like to say thank you. We appreciate your time and your attention. We hope that we've demonstrated the impacts that construction and demolition has on our resources, as well as capturing the evolution of our program over these many years. Since its initial adoption in 2006, Chapter 14 of the Environment Code has grown from reviewing 100 MRRPs a year to over 1,000. We now issue up to 1,000 transporter permits a year to over 400 local businesses. Our team is tasked with enforcing these requirements in the field and over the desktop, averaging more than 100 inspection reports a year with a 90% correction rate, as Kat pointed out earlier. This is accomplished by an emphasis on providing technical assistance and community engagement and communications. I highlight these numbers not only to show the impacts that we have had, but to demonstrate the capacities available to refine and improve our program in areas such as incorporating data and analysis, expanding our community engagement and partnership efforts, and to explore the pursuit of higher and better environmental outcomes, such as deconstruction and reuse of materials. Thank you again for your attention, and we're eager to take any questions.
Great. Thank you, Eric, James, and Kat. It's nice to have the department come back and present on programs after they've been adopted so we can see with the benefit of experience how they're going. Commissioners, any questions or comments?
Just two quick questions. In that second to last slide, the first bullet point, introduce a one-time provisional registration period for facilities to more easily onboard small and emerging businesses to the network. Are you specifically talking about of the 14 facilities, you want to make it easier for them to onboard haulers? Or could you clarify that point?
We currently have 14 registered facilities. We've had up to 15 and we've had less. And we're always looking to expand the number of registered facilities in our network. And so we want to make that process as easy as possible so that those that are not currently registered have a pathway to become registered with us.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes total sense. And then my second question is more anecdotal. So I remember reading before this ordinance came out about the illegal dumping of construction materials throughout San Francisco. Have you seen a marked decrease in that illegal dumping now that this ordinance has gone into effect, or no change at all?
We don't have necessarily specific numbers on that, and it's not obviously part of our presentation in our specific program. I would say that the open and competitive marketplace for these facilities allow for more material to be received and processed properly and to avoid these illegal dumping actions. I think that we're constantly exploring ways to better engage and improve our the understanding of the requirements in the community. And I think the example given of the increase in Tier 1 transporter permits over the last 3 years is a good example of the increased engagement that we're seeing and the opportunities to educate and prevent adverse environmental outcomes.
Generally, I think from your guys' outreach and advocacy efforts, I think, one, those news stories have definitely decreased, which indicates to me it's not as big of an issue as it was before. So I do think that anecdotally there's probably some correlation there, maybe not causation, but still an interesting fact nonetheless.
Yeah, and I think it's if an area that continues to be an interest and an emphasis and allows for cross collaboration with the department as well to try to come up with solutions to this problem.
Thank you.
I have one question, which is these facilities are achieving 65% diversion. So what's getting diverted of the building materials that come into these facilities? What types of stuff is getting diverted? And then where does it go? Who's using it?
Yeah, that's a good question. Just to clarify, the facilities themselves aren't necessarily hitting the 65% recovery requirements. That requirement is on projects to hit. And so, excuse me, so projects have the ability to not only use mixed debris transporters, they also have the ability to source separate at the project site. So say ceiling tiles, drywall, wood, metal, et cetera. That is going to get you a 95 to 100% recovery rate for those source separated materials. And so the project is ultimately the one that's going to be delivering upon this. And so in terms of the facility side, it depends. There's a wide variety of facilities from under 25 tons a day to ones that can receive over 5,000 tons a day. And so depending on the machinery and the methods that they go about recovering materials has a huge impact on what materials come out of it. But dimensional lumber is a key component to that. Concrete, asphalt, inerts is another example. Metals, drywall, ceiling tiles, there's a list of outgoing materials that remain active. Alternative daily cover and beneficial reuse at landfills is a component of that as well. And so there's arguments about whether or not that's actually diversion or not, but currently, as CalGreen states it, it remains so. And so the markets are spread out around the Bay Area, depending on what you're looking at, but say dimensional lumber can be turned into mulch. Those processing facilities are out in the Central Valley. Gypsum drywall, same thing. Those can be turned into soil amendments. Those are also located out in the Central Valley for the most part. Concrete facilities are kind of moving around a little bit. Hopefully that answers some of your question.
Yeah, so some of the 65% is happening through self-separation at the project level, but at the facilities, there's additional stuff that is getting diverted and reused. Are there buyers for this? Has the marketplace kind of figured out that there's good stuff to get out of these facilities, and so people show up to take it away?
Yeah, there's definitely markets in existence and continue to receive these materials. It's an ongoing and continuing emphasis of ours to try to support and maintain those markets because, as happened with Biogen plants a while back, it shut down the market for some wood recovery.
All right. Thank you. Any other comments or questions?
Quick question. Just wanted to learn a little bit more about some of the exemptions for the small business haulers, and then also some of your outreach and kind of updates to the ordinances as far as it relates to assisting those small businesses, and kind of what programs or what does that look like?
Yeah, the specific exemptions that currently exist are for the transporter permits, and it's either for owners of the property or for loads that are less than 1 cubic yard. And an example of some of the difficulties we have is that 1 cubic yard of debris can be represented as a wide variety of different tonnage amounts. And the majority of the receipts that we receive are in tons. And so it gets difficult to try to determine whether or not a cubic yard is less or more and so forth. And so we're looking to clarify that. In terms of engagement, I think part of the approach that we're going to take with potential updates is to either try to have focus groups to get feedback and also give information on these updates.
All right. Looks like you've exhausted our questions, so thank you to the three of you for your presentation. And if there's no further discussion, let's go to public comment.
Are there any members of the public who wish to comment on this item? President Sullivan, we have no speakers.
Then public comment is now closed. Next item, please.
The next item is item 7, presentation on updates to Environment Code Chapter 7, Municipal Green Building Requirements. The speaker for this item is Nick Kessner, Senior Building Decarbonization Coordinator, and this item is for discussion.
Good evening, commissioners. Excited to be here again. All right, let's dive in. This will be a fairly brief update because unlike the last Chapter 7 update, this one was not nearly as comprehensive because my predecessor, Eden, did an excellent job herding cats and making some really dramatic changes, which I'll briefly talk about today. But quick overview, as you know, we have reduced our emissions in the city by about 50% since 1990. The municipal emissions are the ones in dark green at the top. They have been reduced as well over that time, but they do make up a small percentage of our overall climate emissions. And like in many other cases, as you can see on the right side, those municipal emissions did go up since COVID, which is not surprising. The fact that it was only 3% is actually a good sign. But I want to draw your attention to the left side of this diagram, which shows that the vast majority of our emissions are associated with municipal buildings, specifically the combustion of natural gas in our municipal buildings. And if we dig a little bit deeper, we'll see that those emissions are largely at the airport, at hospitals, and at our public schools because of their energy intensity or just the vast number of them, which is also not surprising. And the main reason that we are trying to address those climate emissions going forward is our municipal decarbonization planning efforts, which are based on the municipal natural gas equipment inventory, the portal for which you see here. So every department over the past 2 years has cataloged, with a few exceptions, every piece of natural gas equipment that exists in its building stock. And we are tracking that equipment and its slow and eventual replacement by electric alternatives through this portal that is accessible to representatives from various departments. Now, while that's obviously a major part of our decarbonization efforts, the other piece is our municipal green building requirements, which are enshrined in Environment Code Chapter 7 that covers such things as green rating systems, energy optimization, waste reduction requirements, environmental initiatives around human health, water conservation, and biodiversity. I'm sure this is not new to you. And during the last update in 2023, we made some significant changes over the course of a very intensive process. Kind of the highlights of those changes include the time of replacement requirements for municipal buildings. That means when natural gas equipment breaks or needs to be replaced for other reasons, city municipal buildings do need to replace those pieces of natural gas equipment with electric alternatives. So we are once again setting a milestone and leading in this regard. As you know, the Air District is starting to require this next year for heat pump water heaters only in private buildings. But as a city, we were 4 years ahead of that with this last CAP update. Another major piece of the last CAP update was energy resilience and efficiency measures that applied to community resilience centers. And then we start to really incorporate life cycle analysis into our green building work, and that includes incorporating the concept of embodied energy, or the energy used to make materials, in our analysis of our own municipal building stock. Because of the scale and impact of the last update, this update is relatively simple. It includes some streamlining of requirements for smaller projects. It includes an update of code references, aligning a few items to our CAP update, adding MOCD, the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development, as a member of the Municipal Green Building Task Force, and then expanding the waiver process, as I will quickly describe on the next slide. So one update that we did make, the municipal natural gas equipment inventory that I just described was actually a one-time effort, or was intended as a one-time effort. And as part of this Chapter 7 update, we have just enshrined the fact that municipal departments need to continue updating that inventory as natural gas equipment is replaced so that it doesn't become out of date over time. So that's kind of a minor adjustment because, as you saw, we have a robust portal that makes it super easy for departments to go in and change equipment as they replace it. In terms of the streamlining requirements, what we found is that for small projects and temporary buildings, we were requiring lead checklists, but no comprehensive lead process. So in a small project, you might have a project manager from, let's say, at DPW who oversees that project, but has no consultant assistance in doing lead checklists and implementing them, nor was the lead certification actually required as part of our Chapter 7 updates. So that definitely caused a lot of strain on the on project staff. And after discussing this with the Municipal Green Building Task Force, there was unanimous consensus that small projects less than 10,000 square feet should not be required to fill out a lead checklist without the complete lead support process behind it. Third update I want to just go into a little more detail. LEED v4.1 has been our guiding principle for the last few years. LEED is now updating to version 5 as of January 1st, and there will be no phase-in period, which means we had to move quickly to adjust our Chapter 7 language to include references to LEED v5, whereas right now it still references the old LEED. And then lastly on this slide, I just want to mention that we've clarified what it means to implement our biodiversity guidelines on municipal projects. Specifically, projects need to submit a plant list to the Environment Department so that we can make sure that the kinds of plants that are chosen for projects are aligned with our biodiversity guidelines. And then finally, the last update I want to draw your attention to is expanding the waiver process to affordable housing projects that are seeking an exemption from the all-electric major renovations ordinance that was just passed 2 months ago. You probably remember as we were discussing that process that affordable housing developers and MOCD really wanted to see a little more flexibility for affordable housing sponsors. We did move the implementation back by a year. And then once affordable housing sponsors are required to meet that major renovations ordinance, they do have the option or the possibility of requesting a waiver through the Municipal Green Building Task Force. So it's kind of the first time we've asked private sponsors essentially to come to the task force to get their waivers. And as a result, we had to add MOCD to the task force membership list, and MOCD will be sponsoring those projects essentially as part of the waiver process. So those are kind of the main updates. Just wanted to finish by giving you a timeline of how these will roll out. We've been discussing them in the Municipal Green Building Task Force since January. We're in the process of drafting legislation with the sponsor and city attorney. And then we'll take that final, that drafted legislation, we'll take that around to the different departments that are impacted by Chapter 7 guidelines to get their blessing so that this can be heard by the full Board of Supervisors early in the new year. And with that, I wrap up my presentation, and I look forward to any questions you may have.
Thank you for that concise update. Commissioners, questions or discussion? I realize this isn't part of your presentation, but is there a building that comes to mind in terms of a conversion from moving in the direction of all electric around the city in the last year or two? Is there some?
A municipal project or any project?
Well, municipal. I think this is about municipal.
Yeah,
right?
Okay. So we have the PUC actually has an electric a team that works on electrifying municipal buildings, and I will say that most of their projects are focused on kind of smaller buildings that Rec and Park might own or library facilities. So there have been some retrofit projects in that space. We look forward to supporting a electrification of a kind of a big kahuna, like a project that really has an old boiler, maybe that's decades old. I know that the county jail is looking to replace some boilers, and so we need to think about how to electrify that that building, which is obviously a massive building on 7th Street. So I don't have a good one for you that's kind of the scale of this particular building we're in, but electrification at the smaller scale is already happening as we speak, yeah.
Great, thank you.
What are some of the major updates with LEED V5, and does it present you with any challenges, or do you feel like you're pretty well set up for implementing?
There's a big emphasis on decarbonization and to a much higher degree than before. And I think in some ways it mirrors the shift from efficiency to electrification. In the past, we talked about being less bad, and now we kind of have this ultimate project that needs to happen to achieve zero emissions in a particular building. So that's one big emphasis for them. And then the embodied carbon piece is being built out a lot more as well. So in a way, LEED is catching up with what we started doing last time around. Yeah. If you like more questions, I'm happy to have my colleague Barry also go into detail.
All right. I think thanks again for your presentation.
Sure.
If there's no further discussion, let's go to public comment.
Are there any members of the public who wish to comment on this item? President Sullivan, we have no speakers.
Thank you. Then public comment is closed. Next item, please.
The next item is item 8, review and vote on whether to approve resolution file 2025-07-COE, resolution urging the Board of Supervisors, Mayor, and Commission Streamlining Task Force to support retaining the Commission on the Environment's governance body status. The sponsor for this item is Mike Sullivan, President of the Commission on the Environment, and the explanatory document is resolution file 2025-07-COE. This item is for discussion and possible action.
Thank you. Commissioners, I'm putting forth this resolution because I believe the city has benefited enormously from this commission and its oversight of the Environment Department. Thanks to all of our efforts, past and present, San Francisco has established itself as a global climate leader, a place that other cities try to emulate. Our work in tandem with the department has helped San Francisco pass innovative environmental policies and adopt climate initiatives that have had a ripple effect across the state, the country, and even internationally. We all know that the federal government is standing down on climate protection, and so we need to step up. Converting the Commission on the Environment to an advisory body, one that will disappear after 3 years, is contrary to the message that we want to send as a city. The environment is a top priority, and that we stand by the commitment we made in 2019 to address the climate emergency facing San Francisco. And words matter. When we say something is an emergency, it suggests that it should be a priority. And it's always the job of the city family to allocate resources, but we do have an emergency. The world has an emergency. The country has an emergency, and we have an emergency in San Francisco that we need to address. Maintaining the Commission on the Environment's government body status, as well as adequately funding the department and the implementation of the Climate Action Plan, are crucial to San Francisco maintaining its status as a climate leader. So with that, commissioners, I want to ask if there's any discussion or questions relating to resolution file 2025-07-COE.
So I would like to make additional comments as well. So as you've heard, for nearly three decades, the Commission of the Environment has embodied San Francisco's conscience and conviction on environmental stewardship and climate responsibility. Created by the will of the voters and embedded in the city charter, it was entrusted with governance authority because transformational climate action requires transparency, accountability, independence, and a strong public voice. Reducing the commission to a temporary advisory body destined to sunset is not administrative efficiency. It is a retreat from responsibility at a time when San Francisco should be strengthening, not dismantling, environmental leadership. In this era of accelerating climate crisis, environmental injustice, federal rollbacks, and local budget cuts, we cannot afford to weaken the very institution designed to safeguard the public interest and advance climate action. The Commission has been more than a policymaking forum. It has been a public steward of environmental values, a guardian of intergenerational voices, and a champion for equity and resilience. Its leadership drove landmark achievements: zero waste innovation, building electrification, hazardous waste protections, environmental justice grants, and aggressive net zero emissions goals, primarily self-reliant and disproportionately funded through grants versus general fund dollars. San Francisco declared a climate emergency, but an emergency declaration without empowered institutions becomes empty symbolism. Eliminating the Commission's governance role would silence the only public body dedicated solely to environmental and climate advocacy. It would undermine environmental justice by removing a forum that ensures frontline communities are heard and protected. Black, brown, immigrant, and low-income communities who have long borne the burden of toxic exposure and climate risk would again be pushed to the margins. The climate crisis, wildfire smoke, extreme heat, toxic pollution, health impacts, and displacement are not advisory matters. They are real harms affecting real people now. Our children's future cannot depend on non-binding advice. Environmental governance must remain a core function of our city and not an optional committee subject to political convenience. The Commission on the Environment must continue to stand as advocate for the public good over short-term interests, guardian of the environmental equity and climate resilience across every San Francisco neighborhood, custodian of San Francisco's environmental legacy, guided by the people and accountable to the people. We do not move forward by dismantling what keeps us accountable. We move forward by honoring what works, evolving what must improve, and protecting what must endure. The West African principle of Sankofa teaches, we must look back to carry forward the wisdom of the past. The Commission reflects that wisdom, proving that public participation, justice, and innovation are not competing values. They are the foundation of durable climate leadership. Weakening the Commission now works against the climate and environmental justice zeitgeist of our time. Advisory bodies can recommend, and only governance can ensure action and deliver change and accountability. For these reasons, I strongly support retaining the Commission on the Environment as a governance body with full authority to oversee environmental policy, advance climate action, protect community health, and champion environmental justice in San Francisco. To do otherwise would send a dangerous message that in a moment of crisis, San Francisco chose to step backward when it needed to stand firm and lead. Now is the time to recommit, not retreat. The future demands climate and environmental leadership. The people demand accountability, and the planet demands action. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Tompkins. Other comments or discussion on this item?
I would just like to add how I'm wholeheartedly in agreement with President Sullivan, Vice President Tompkins, and the statement you just made. In particular, San Francisco has been very active on a global stage, for example, with C40 Cities, which is a network of mayors from who have signed on to make sure that cities from Mexico City to Paris to San Francisco have had a leading role in talking about the climate crisis. And in that role, we, I think, also demonstrate to the world how serious we are as a city and a county at looking at how it impacts our residents at the local level. So it isn't just talking about something that's way out there that is not tangible, but cities work on specific projects that are can be seen by the residents. San Francisco has been a leader in that. The work that San Francisco has done has was recognized in Copenhagen a couple of years ago. And now, Director Ju, I know we were both there to listen to what cities are doing, how we learn from each other. And I think San Francisco has always been at the forefront of making sure that when we're talking about how cities are governing and how they lead and how they see the impact at the very local level, we have an important role, especially at this time, to be a full-fledged commission with the authority and hopefully the funding to carry on our work. So thank you for bringing that resolution. I completely agree and support it wholeheartedly.
Thank you, Commissioner Bermejo.
The only thing that I would add at this point is this is the start of what will be a very long process. So thank you for kicking us off and getting us started on the right note. As we ship out this resolution, it's important to make sure that it is not just heard, but it is understood. And I think that's where we all can play a part as commissioners in pushing forth a strong conversation, of course, with the help of Charles and the director, meaning reaching out to your supervisor to make sure that this was received and understood. The boards that many of us sit on, making sure that those organizations actively participate, sending letters themselves, engaging community to make sure that the consequences of this decision is understood. So with that, of course, this has my full support, and thank you for getting us started.
Thank you, Commissioner Hunter. Commissioner Riles?
Yeah, equally just want to express my thanks to the President and to the Vice President for your comments and your leadership on the commission and to my other commissioners for their comments as well. And, you know, I feel a little bit like I'm the new kid here, you know, and so I'm very grateful for the opportunity to serve and very grateful to the mayor for the appointment here. And, you know, I just want to acknowledge, too, I think what the voters of San Francisco have done is asked for a more efficient government across the board. I think we can all share in that spirit, myself included. And I would just say, in that spirit, I've been so impressed by how much this agency manages with so few resources. It's been incredible to see. I think right now, particularly in this environment when all of us are being asked to deliver more with less, it's been just tremendous to see the staff and everyone and all of the hard work that they're doing to deliver on their obligations, not just because it's a statutory thing, but because I think they genuinely come to work every day hoping to make a difference for the people of San Francisco. And I've been just so impressed with that. And I just want to acknowledge that in the spirit when we're looking for a more efficient government, I have been so impressed by how efficient this agency and this department is. And also, I think right now when we're talking a lot about San Francisco's economic recovery, one thing that has struck me just as being a new commissioner is how much work this agency does with small businesses, not just to enable them to make better choices, to make better economic choices for themselves, to think about how they focus on their bottom line. I've been really, really impressed by all the various directors and departments within the agency that have come and presented on that. It's been just been so incredible to think not about just environmental policy being about clean air and clean water, but just about making sure businesses can make the right economic choice for themselves and think about San Francisco as a place to invest in. The other thing I've been so impressed by is just the engagement with the community, especially youth. Youth activism has been so refreshing to see. I love every opportunity we come here, and this room is filled with all of the folks that are working either on an internship or they're here for a fellowship or they're involved in their youth programs or they're involved in their neighborhood or the community. They expect us to deliver on this commitment that this agency has made, and I cannot imagine a recovery of San Francisco that is not mindful of the youth and their desire to see things like this go forward. So I've just been really, really incredibly impressed by that. So, and last thing I'll just say, too, I've been really intrigued by some of the public comments that we've received over the few months that I've been on the commission, looking to this agency to be a sort of a cross-functional whole-of-government repository to help solve problems, right, in the spirit of you know, making sure we have a more efficient government. It's been interesting to see the public come here and say, hey, will you help me with this other agency? Will you help me remove this other barrier and this other roadblock? So I do think in the spirit of looking at a more efficient government, of being focused on the long-term economic recovery of San Francisco and enabling the youth, this resolution has got my full-throated support, and I'm very, very thankful that you all brought it forward and just want to make sure that we go on public and offering those other ideas, too, about the need for this commission and for the great work that this agency does every day.
Thank you, Commissioner Riles.
Yeah, I'll just say something real quick, which I'd, you know, in support of this commission is really the public forum that it allows, that this information exists publicly, that people can see all the great work that this department is doing and learn from it, not just, you know, here in Bay Area, California, but worldwide, being climate and environmental leaders. So if you take away this commission, there isn't this forum for this information to even be out there and discussed, let alone for the public to have comment and input that drives some of the policies and decisions and projects that this department's working on. So again, if you take away this commission, you take away this medium for discussion and for information to be out there. So
absolutely. Yeah, these resolutions hitting two points. One is that if this commission goes away, the city loses the only public forum devoted to the environment and climate. And secondly, resources. We are dangerously close to losing the department's ability to do its job and to manage the climate action plan. So I'm glad that we're hitting both points in these resolutions. So if there's no more discussion, do I hear a motion and a second?
A motion from
Commissioner Riles and a second from Commissioner Hunter. So I think we should go to public comment then.
Are there any members of the public who wish to comment on this item? Please come forward to the podium and state your name.
Hi all, Lila Holzman, an engaged citizen, just like to come to these meetings for fun and really respect all the work that you all are doing. I'm learning a lot. I've also been going to the Commission Streamlining Task Force meetings. Some of them are very long, very interesting, lots of public comments. I was at the one where this commission was discussed, and just maybe you already know some of this, but I wanted to note that that task force fully supports what this commission is doing and what the Department of the Environment is doing and acknowledges how important San Francisco's leadership in climate is. That was not a question. It got into the weeds and kind of wonky on what's the difference between a governance body and an advisory body, and their thought was actually that I'm an observer, still learning, but from what it sounded like to me is that being an advisory committee could actually give you more flexibility, could expand the number of members on the commission, which could be helpful if, as they're also recommending, the Urban Forestry Council actually goes away, and then that gets kind of absorbed into yours. So that could make being an advisory committee actually more helpful from a logistics standpoint and like how to enable you to still pass resolutions, still advise on policy, still do the important work you're doing, but perhaps more in a flexible way. But I don't think they necessarily understood and maybe would be open to listening to. Their staff seems very approachable to understanding better what governance functions really need to be a governance body for versus things that you do that could actually be either category. And on the sunset thing, I also was like, asking about why sunset after 3 years. That seems to be their default. They don't actually want your commission to go away. They just want commissions in general to not exist in perpetuity without that check on efficiency, like, do we still need this commission? I think the assumption is that this commission would continue to be renewed every 3 years. I personally think that if you also want to recommend to them that they take away that sunset provision, they would probably be open to that too. So yeah, just throwing it out there because I was in that very long meeting, and I do think they have your full you have their full support. I think the vote was like 4-5 on converting to an advisory versus governance, but everyone agreed that the commission needed to stay and exist, and no one was recommending taking it away. So just FYI. Thanks.
Thank you for that input.
Are there any other members of the public who wish to comment on this item? President Sullivan, we have no more speakers.
Thank you, Alice. Then public comment is now closed. Please call the roll for item 8.
President Sullivan?
Aye.
Vice President Tompkins?
Aye.
Commissioner Ahn is excused. Commissioner Bermejo?
Aye.
Commissioner Hunter?
Aye.
Commissioner Riles?
Aye.
Commissioner Yuen?
Aye.
I'm glad to say the motion passes. Next item, please.
The next item is item 9, Director's Report. Speaker is Tyrone Jew, Director.
Well, on that note, yesterday night I'll just let folks know I had the privilege of opening up the California Interfaith Power and Light convening that happened right here in San Francisco over in Fort Mason. It was a gathering of faith institutions from across California. Of course, they chose San Francisco to be here to host their event. And my message to them was similar to what the commission just mentioned around kind of the role that this department has played in shaping this story around sustainability in the city. And the number of people that came up afterwards from cities all across California just thanking the city for still being a leader in climate was amazing. Like, it was like this line of people coming from all over. Just thanking us for keeping up the fight. So I wanted to share that message as you passed your resolution. From the teams, we have a couple things to note. From the climate team, we did want to note that Board President Mandelman has introduced a resolution voicing the city's support for the Bay Area Air District's Rules 9496. As a reminder, that's to phase out NOx appliances from buildings starting in 2027. And so that is making its way through the resolution process at the board. Over the past month, one of the fun things, and I don't know why this is under the climate team update, but I'm guessing it's under the climate team update because they won. The entire department participated in a department-wide sustainability challenge. And so over a month, we were cataloging all of our individual actions and competing, program teams were competing against each other. And I will announce, because it's part of my notes, that the climate team, Nick, Cindy are here from the climate team, were the winners and champions. So we had a nice little ceremony for them. And I will tell you, going towards the final hours, it was very, very competitive. People were taking that very seriously. I do want to congratulate and thank Brian and Jax, who are helping kind of spearhead that initiative in the department. We were testing it because we would like to also expand this up to other departments to expand this challenge, right, to make sustainability and climate action fun, get everyone engaged. So hats off to the team and the winners. The climate team also, for the building decarbonization team, is continuing their great work. They have a workshop tomorrow or Wednesday, continuing their training for small local contractors to get them certified on heat pump water heater installations. In the past, they just completed a training for food service professionals that drew an impressive turnout. They had 138 public health staff from 29 counties across California, representing 50% of the state, including all 9 Bay Area counties, to learn about how they should be incorporating this into their own rule. So again, San Francisco leading the way and bringing folks together from across the state. And we have, Nick was also featured on KLW, Clean Air, talking about our building decarbonization work and strategies. On the Zero Waste team, we had an amazing week last week where we were hosting, speaking of C40 cities, Commissioner Bermejo. We had visitors from cities across the United States gathered here from the C40 Cities Food Waste and Procurement Network. They were learning firsthand what we are doing here and how we are leading in food recovery and food waste here in the city. So again, another example of how San Francisco is kind of sharing what we are doing here and also learning from others, right? I don't want to make it seem like San Francisco is the only one teaching. We're learning from all these other cities as well, but they're gathering here for a reason. And the team really did an amazing job setting up a week-long of events showcasing our community partners and different organizations that are connected to this food recovery effort. We were visiting the D10 Community Market. We had Supervisor Walton there. We had stops at Farming Hope, where Food Connect and FaxSF shared insights. And then we topped it off with a press conference at the SF Produce Market, or SF Market, over in the Bayview, where they celebrated their 10 millionth pound of food recovered through their organization. So that's food being recovered from this wholesale warehouse being put in the hands of families in need. And what I said at that press conference and what I've been telling everyone is this offsets the need, to your point, Commissioner Riles, this offsets the need to have to cover those costs from those families that will still need food on the table. And we're doing this through all of our work, through enacting SB 1383 and our partnerships with community. Also want to highlight that we also talked around our launch of our sustainable food procurement dashboard, which is now live on our SFE website under city staff resources. So we're also pushing our municipal departments on what type of food we're procuring. And then on the delegation side, we hosted a delegation from South Korea. This time it was our Toxics Reduction and Healthy Communities team with Pauli presenting on our programs around electric landscaping equipment and other VOC reduction initiatives. We also had an Asia Pacific Development Fellowship where they brought a cohort of 11 fellows that met with our policy and comms team and climate and clean transportation teams to learn about our work. So every single one of these examples, and this just happened from the last commission meeting to this commission meeting, that's, you can see like we're engaging with people throughout the state, throughout the country, outside of the country too, and they're still coming here to learn about what we are doing. And so it very much connects to everything that was done earlier with the resolution. On the clean transportation team, I want to recognize Commission President Sullivan for attending the Charge Across Town event during Fleet Week. The theme was Plug In and Go, Driving Access and Inclusion in the Electric Future, highlighting how communities across California and the nation are benefiting from electrification, especially around EVs. And so thank you for being part of that panel discussion at the Commonwealth Club. And on the budget front, I did say that I would give an update on our budget each meeting. We are continuing conversations on our budget. I do not have any positive or concrete news to present on that front. I can say that internal conversations are beginning to move more quickly, just as I can see direction being given from the mayor's budget office on various activities. And so work is still happening. We're continuing our meetings almost weekly with the mayor's office regarding our funding issues. So those conversations are still ongoing.
Thank you, Director Ju. Any questions on that item? If not, let's go to public comment.
Are there any members of the public who wish to comment on this item? President Sullivan, we have no speakers.
Then public comment is now closed. Next item, please.
Next item is item 10, new business and future agenda items with Speaker Charles Sheehan, Chief Policy and Public Affairs Officer. This item is for discussion.
Thank you. Commissioners, good evening. It's hard to believe we're at December, but our next meeting is December 2nd. And then looking ahead for January, where we always discuss our budget priorities. That's a bit of a tricky meeting to schedule. I think we're shooting for January 6th. Is that correct, Alice? January 6th?
Tuesday, January 6th.
Tuesday, January 6th. So please look out for some scheduling emails for that January meeting. For the December meeting, we will bring to you for your approval the Buy Green Report, as we typically do each year. And then we are looking at a whole host of other possible presentations, could relate to our climate action plan, to some grantees. We also have to present on climate resilience. If you recall, about a year ago, our director noted that one of the civil grand jury's report that tackled the large topic of climate resilience throughout the city had a number of recommendations for a number of departments. One of the recommendations was for our department to host a hearing looking at assessing, talking about the impacts of climate resilience projects on the community, the unintended impacts, and so we will be bringing that forward for the December meeting as well. It's a recommendation we accepted from the civil grand jury, and so we have to bring it forward, and we will be doing that in December. And there could be other topic items, and those could also spill over to January, so we are looking at a busy December and potentially a busy January and February where we discuss the two budgets at the two commission meetings. I'll take questions now.
Thank you, Charles. Any questions, Commissioner Hunter?
Just on the third public comment we got about the urban canopy.
Yes.
I was surprised to learn that it would be a block by block variance to ask for trees to be planted on your block. At the same time, I know part of our climate action plan and the biodiversity section, we specifically call out the urban canopy. However, if we don't plant trees in Chinatown, Bayview's Hunter Point, basically the impacted areas, we're not really meeting that. So one of the presentations I would suggest is a presentation on that DPW directive.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'll do my own research before coming to you with a bunch of questions, Charles.
Sure. We can put that on the docket as a possible presentation, potentially a co-partnership presentation with Public Works. We'll have to talk to them about that, but that's a potentially a good one to add to the list.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Charles. Appreciate it. Let's go to public comment.
Are there any members of the public who wish to comment on this item? President Sullivan, we have no speakers.
Then public comment is now closed. Next item, please.
The next item is item 11, adjournment. The meeting is adjourned. The time is 6:15 p.m. Thank you for joining us.